Welcome to episode 19 of Vashon 250. Today we're looking at the creation of the Navy by the Second Continental Congress. Thinking about how the colonists got to the New World, the Navy was rooted in the American seafaring tradition, which produced a large community of sailors, captains, and shipbuilders during the colonial era. During the Revolution, several states operated their own navies. On June 12, 1775, the Rhode Island General Assembly passed a resolution creating a navy for the colony of Rhode Island. It had a fleet of 2 to 3 small vessels and ultimately ended in 1780. 5 years, that's not bad. The first formal movement for the creation of the Navy came from Rhode Island because the widespread smuggling activities of Rhode Island merchants had been increasingly suppressed by the British Royal Navy. On October 26, 1775, Rhode Island passed a resolution that there would be a single Continental fleet funded by the Continental Congress. The resolution was introduced in the Continental Congress on October 3, 1775, but was tabled. In the meantime, George Washington had begun to acquire ships, starting with the schooner USS Hannah that was paid for out of Washington's own pocket. Hannah was commissioned and launched on September 5, 1775, under the command of Captain Nicholas Broughton from the port of Marblehead, Massachusetts. The United States Navy claims October 13, 1775 as the date of its official establishment when the Second Continental Congress passed a resolution creating the Continental Navy. On this day, Congress authorized the purchase of 2 vessels to be armed for a privateering cruise against British merchant shipping. On December 13, 1775, Congress authorized the building of 13 frigates within the next 3 months, 5 ships of 32 guns, 5 with 28 guns, and 3 with 24 guns. With the end of the American Revolutionary War under the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the Continental Navy was disbanded within 2 years. A faction of Congress wanted to keep the Navy, but there was no money, and priorities of the new nation changed, something that we will see for the next 250 years. National income was desperately needed, and most came from tariffs on imported goods. Because of rampant smuggling, the need was immediate for strong enforcement of tariff laws. On October 4, 1790, the United States Congress, urged on by the Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, created the Revenue Marine, the forerunner for the United States Coast Guard, to enforce the tariff and all other maritime laws. 10 cutters were initially ordered. Between 1790 and 1797, when the Navy Department was created, the Revenue Marine was the only armed maritime service for the United States. Under the presidency of George Washington, merchant shipping came under threat while in the Mediterranean by Barbary pirates from 4 North African states. This led to the Navy Act of 1794, which created a permanent standing U.S. Navy. The original 6 frigates were authorized as part of the act. Over the next 20 years, the Navy fought the French Republic Navy in the Quasi-War, 1798 to 99, Barbary states in the First and Second Barbary Wars, and the British in the War of 1812. After the War of 1812, the U.S. Navy was at peace until the Mexican-American War in 1846 and served to combat piracy in the Mediterranean and Caribbean seas, as well as fighting the slave trade off the west coast of Africa. In 1845, the Naval Academy was founded at Old Fort Severn at Annapolis, Maryland, by the Chesapeake Bay. In 1861, the American Civil War began, and the U.S. Navy fought the small Confederate States Navy with both sailing ships and new revolutionary ironclad ships while forming a blockade that shut down the Confederacy's civilian coastal shipping. After the Civil War, most of the ships were laid up in reserve, and by 1878, the Navy was just 6,000 men. By that point, the Navy realized it had no ability to fight a battle, and efforts began to rebuild the Navy. The big change came in 1901 under President Teddy Roosevelt. The Navy went from being the 6th largest to the 2nd largest behind the British. Growth resumed after World War I, after which Hoover pushed disarmament until FDR came into leadership. Worldwide expansion came during World War II. After the war, reduction in ships happened yet again. Today, there are about 275 ships in the Navy, the smallest fleet since World War I. Today's budget for the Department of the Navy is $292.2 billion, 24 0.4% of the total Department of Defense $925 billion budget. During the last 250 years of American history, there are a number of times that Congress has created new branches of the military to better serve the needs of the country. What are some of the most significant of those historic events, Bruce?
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about the creation of the Navy itself, particularly, and we'll hear this in a couple of weeks when Brian Long is here, sort of channeling, Thomas Paine and Common Sense, because Thomas Paine in Common Sense spends quite a bit of time talking about the potential of an American Navy. You know, he provides sort of a back of the envelope calculation of sort of, how much the British Navy cost Great Britain, how many ships they had that were unfit for duty, and how many could be committed to the American Revolution versus dealing with the rest of the British Empire. And so, Thomas Paine comes up with the sense that if the United States, the new emerging United States, had only 1/20th of what the British had, we could hold them at bay. And he looked at what we had in terms of forest resources. I mean, we had sort of, at that time, unlimited forest resources. We had a whole cadre of people along the coast who grew up as fishermen and traders and sailors and whalers. And I mean, so we had this incredible sort of resource of personnel, if you will, who knew the sea. And so Thomas Paine sort of concludes that the Americans should form a Navy. We've got the ability to do it. We've got the resources to do it. And we could largely hold the British at bay. So it's important to think back to what America had versus what Britain had. Britain had already established Navy. They had overwhelming sort of numbers, but they also had worldwide commitments. We had one commitment.
Yes. And so we look at history and where are we today? We're kind of in that same boat that Britain was in.
Yeah, exactly.
Worldwide commitments. And,
exactly.
And generally not enough resources to build new ships.
Yeah.
I mean, we're building them, but they aren't necessarily the best.
Well,
which is a challenge in itself.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we have a whole industry built around building aircraft carriers that
right.
nobody else has.
Right.
So
exactly.
I think, what do we have, 20 in service today?
Right.
And we just keep building new ones.
Right.
And we're the only ones really that could do that. And the Brits have tried their new ones and they're not working very well.
Yeah. And the Chinese, Chinese have built several new aircraft carriers. And it's that classic sort of situation that navies, that any military confronts, is the changing technology. You know, in the 1930s, aircraft carriers were new, and Japan bet heavily on them and was very successful at the beginning of World War II until midway. We sank four of their six major carriers, and it turned the course of the war in the Pacific. But also the sense that each technology that comes along is outpaced by a new technology. And so we look at the American aircraft carrier fleet right now, and how effective is it going to be against a swarm of drones? An aircraft carrier cost how many billions of dollars? A drone cost $4,000. You know, and you just sort of go into the mathematics of that. And it's sort of really going to be interesting, particularly with our current war with Iran and in the Gulf, what's going to happen with the traditional American approach to naval power. And then you look at that in terms of what's going to happen with the Straits of Taiwan and with China, and with China ever decides to take over Taiwan, all of a sudden America has a sort of supply line that's what, 6,000 miles long. Mm-hmm. China has a supply line that's on their shores. And can we effectively, with our carrier forces, hold off a Chinese invasion of Taiwan? And every war game that I've seen reported says that Taiwan's going to fall very quickly to the Chinese. We can't do it.
It'll be interesting to see, and hopefully we don't have to.
Yeah. In our lifetime, I think we will. But also, you think about the creation of the Navy and what it means for the American military, the sense that we have created new branches of service all along to meet specific needs. You know, you mentioned earlier, John, the revenue service, which becomes the Coast Guard. I mean, that was built around the need to control smuggling, to collect tariffs, those sort of things that funded the early American government. You know, you have in 1789, the creation of the U.S. Marines as a separate branch of service to work alongside the Navy. In 1907, you have the creation of the Army Air Force, responding to the emergence of aircraft as a new technology. And then in 1947, the Army Air Force is actually broken off and becomes the U.S. Air Force, a separate branch of service. You know, in 1947, as a result of the experience in World War II, and sort of the idea of you had a Department of the Navy and you had a Department of War, which was the Army, you had the Coast Guard service, you had all these sort of various military branches, all with their own sort of administrations. And in 1947, we create the Department of Defense, basically to pull those all together so that we'd have a uniform sort of coordinated response to military needs. And then in 2019, of course, we have the creation of the Space Force, you know, that's sort of the new frontier, if you will. And so when you look at this sort of sweep of American history in terms of creating services and branches of services, you know, it's always been a response to a new emerging technology. And I think we'll continue to see that. I would not be surprised to see a drone force emerge at some point. And when you get into AI and robotics and look at what that impact on warfare would be, particularly if you have lethal robotic, you know, instruments, you know, robots and drones and things like that that are outside of human control, you know, you really begin to get the Matrix kind of concept of what are we getting into.
And when we look at the war in Ukraine, they have become very, very clever, and we're learning a lot about how to do things without people.
Exactly.
Well, we have people, but they're doing it electronically. We're helping. We're learning.
Yep.
And there's been notable change.
Yeah, exactly. And it, what it does is it keeps human beings off of the front lines. But what does this do to the front lines? And we're seeing that in the Ukraine war in particular, you know, where the Ukrainians have become experts at using these robotic, you know, drones and sort of other kinds of advanced technologies. And it's brought the Russian Empire to a standstill.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sort of one of the largest armies and militaries in the world has been stymied by this small country.
Well, I have a good friend who lives in Gig Harbor, not far from the docks, and her son is in the U.S. Marines, and he's in New Orleans sitting behind a computer console driving that kind of stuff. She can't tell me what he actually does, but he was basically a teenage gamer, and he's there behind the screens shooting drones around. And the idea that you'd ever be called up into the Great Sandbox or anything like that is probably slim to none. They've got a whole operation down there. So we go from Space Force and a lot of this new stuff. It's worth talking about that old technology usually beats new technology. And we saw that in Vietnam with the Viet Cong just using basic stuff to defeat us, and we got kicked. And I think that continues to go on. So that sort of proves that that axiom that the old traditional beats the newfangled stuff. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the classic statement has always been that low tech beats high tech. And we see it across the board. And Vietnam is sort of a great example. I mean, you look at what the United States brought to the Vietnam War in terms of military technology. I mean, it should have been a cakewalk. but it wasn't, and for a whole lot of reasons. But one is that, the Vietnamese were on their own territory and they were using tried and true old technologies that they had mastered. And we were constantly trying to respond to those old technologies with newer technologies. And they affect, in effect, I mean, they would work, but the old technologies were easy to modify, whereas new high technologies are very difficult to modify. And in the midst of a combat situation, in the midst of a war, things move very, very quickly, and they move in very unexpected ways. And it's very difficult to respond, particularly with technology.
And that's why the Ukrainians are interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
They have just, it's been the mother of invention gotten them through, and our money. But we also spent 20 years in Afghanistan and ran into some of the same stuff there.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I suspect right now with this war in Iran that we're seeing right now and the struggle in the Straits of Hormuz, we've got all the technology. We've got all the jet planes and the aircraft carriers and, the high tech. But at the same time, Strait of Hormuz is still closed.
Yeah.
And I don't see it opening anytime soon.
So let's look ahead. We live in the midst of an ongoing constitutional crisis that's developed over the last 5 or 6 years. What lessons does the creation of the Navy offer us today?
Well, I think in terms of the American, larger American sort of a view of the world, it's that sense that we need to be able to respond as situations change. What you see with the creation of the United States Navy is that the Continental Congress was recognizing at each stage that they needed to build the kinds of ships and they needed to do the kinds of things that it took to respond to this massive sort of a British empire that had worldwide commitments. And so the U.S. Navy really begins as a bunch of privateers. Mm-hmm. And a privateer is essentially a pirate with legal standing.
Yes.
Because the government says go out and harass the enemy. And so the United States Navy really begins as a sort of ad hoc group of privateers out there, harassing the British. And then it becomes apparent that we need more substantial ships and we need more of them. And so they begin to build the first set of frigates, and that goes on. And those become the basis of the American Navy in the War of 1812. And then by the Civil War, what you see is emergence of a new technology with ironclads and with steam. And all of a sudden, the old sailing Navy that the U.S. Navy began as and that the British sort of ruled the world with was quickly bypassed. And the late 19th century is this sort of struggle to develop a new kind of Navy that responds to these new technologies. And what you get, essentially, is the development of a dreadnought-type battleship. And a sort of battleships control the navies of the world up until World War II. And then, as I mentioned earlier, Japan sort of realized they could build battleships, but they could also build aircraft carriers. And very early on with Pearl Harbor, the power of aircraft carriers and the power of naval aircraft all of a sudden was well demonstrated. And the nature of naval warfare changed. And then you get into wars like the Falklands War, where a British frigate is taken out by an Exocet missile, a missile that costs, $5,000 or $10,000 takes out a billion-dollar, naval frigate. And it's all of a sudden, wow, what kind of wars are we fighting? And that's what I see happening right now. We have these dominant naval forces. The United States sort of right now did have the largest navy in the world. China's just recently overtaken it as the largest navy in the world. But all of a sudden, you see drones and missiles, and all of a sudden, how are these sort of aircraft task forces that we rely on going to stand up to these new technologies? I think it's a fascinating time
Well, and then if we look at private space programs like SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, what role are they going to be playing? Certainly, they're making a lot of money throwing satellites up in the air for you know, so we can watch TV. But there's a lot more going on there, and it's just going to. And they're very wealthy people; they can do whatever they want to do. It wouldn't be how I'd spend the money if it was me, but you know, whatever. But what are those programs going to mean for all this kind of stuff?
Well, a lot of it. I mean, we're recording this on the day that SpaceX is going public for the first time.
Yes.
And may well be the first $1 trillion corporation in the world. And so you're right. But again, those technologies are fragile. You know, I mean, the Chinese are putting a lot of effort into figuring out how to knock out satellites. And all of a sudden, if you've got drone technologies that's dependent on communications through satellites, and the satellites are knocked out, what does that do with your drone technology? Or what does that do with your naval forces? So I think we're at a very, very interesting time. And to move, my personal opinion here, to move those kinds of things like communications into the private realm of private corporations rather than the public realm is a major mistake. Because, you know, governments, you know, love them or leave them, governments need to be able to control the public airways.
Agreed. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's, I was speaking with a couple of people just the other day about their Starlink service and how much they like it. And they asked me what I had, and I still have cable, Comcast, and most of the time it works. But it does raise the question. They're thoroughly delighted with the service they have. That'll never happen in our house because my wife is not wild about Elon Musk. Now, once the company goes public, who knows? It's an interesting question. And then I can't help but think of our old, forget the USS Constitution in Boston that still has a whole grove of oak trees to keep it going. And not that she'll ever fight again, but you never know.
Exactly.
So let's look at Vashon and events that echo the formation of special services like we've been talking about.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this the other night, trying to think how to respond to that question. And I find it fascinating when you think about the sort of the progression of the development of the U.S. Navy. Okay? It goes from privateers into the formation of a Navy, into a transition from, you know, from sail to steam, you know, a transition from wooden ships to the iron ships, a transition from battleships to aircraft carriers, and then a transition that we're in the midst of right now from aircraft carriers into drones and missile-related sort of warfare. And of course, underlying all that, if you will, are submarines. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this interesting sort of progression. And I think that progression is echoed in Vashon's experiences with ferries. The ferry system in Vashon really wasn't a ferry system. It was a group of privateers, if you will. It was a group of private, you know, Mosquito Fleet boats owned by individuals running specific routes, serving specific communities, and that dominated Vashon's ferry service from the earliest time, from the 1880s and 1890s, up until the 1930s and 1940s. And what's interesting also was there's that transition, just as the Navy transitioned from wooden ships to ironclads and from sail to steam. You know, the ferries on Puget Sound transitioned from steam to diesel, and it changed the nature of how those ships operated. And then just as the battleship emerges as sort of the dominant force and then aircraft carriers, what you see on Vashon ferries is the emergence of, you know, public ferry services. the Vashon Ferry District is formed, and out of that and other things at the same time grows the Washington State Ferry System. So you've got all these parallels that I think are very fascinating. And there's one other parallel that I think is very, very interesting to me, is when you look at the state of the U.S. Navy today, and you sort of referenced that, John, earlier on, is sort of today we have a Navy that's basically falling apart in many ways. I mean, it's a wonderful service, and the aircraft carriers are magnificent machines, but our ability to replace them, our ability to build new ships, has rapidly declined. And when you look at the Washington State Ferry System, when it was first formed, number one, it was going to be a temporary thing. It was going to be replaced by bridges, but that never happened. And so it becomes permanent. And so by the, it's formed in the 1950s, early 1950s. And so by the 1970s and 1980s, the state realizes, well, we've got to invest in ferries. And so what they do is they begin to build a new, whole new set of ferries in the 1980s and 1990s. And those are the ferries we still have today, because we, our ferry service has declined and deteriorated in the same way our naval ships have declined and deteriorated. So there's these very fascinating parallels, I think, between the development of the Continental Navy and the U.S. Navy and the development of ferry service on Vashon Island.
Well, and if you think back to the 80s, in the 90s, but certainly the 80s, we had more shipyards locally that don't exist today, and they're not coming back.
No,
and
exactly.
So then you look to build the next round in Florida, or the Gulf. But what as you speak, it's interesting to think that our next round of ferries will be electric. But is that really the right technology? Are we already behind the game on it? Before the first keel is even laid.
Sure. And it's sort of another parallel is the U.S. Navy, after World War II, becomes an aircraft navy. It becomes aircraft carriers. It becomes, an air navy, if you will. The Washington State Ferry System built itself as a car ferry service. Well, now it's really passenger-only service tends to be more important than car service in many ways.
So we're back to a mosquito fleet.
we are. And it's that sort of full circle that you see the United States Navy going through, and you see the Washington State Ferry System going through, and you see Vashon dependent on that. So I think there's some fascinating parallels.
And politics dominates all of it.
Indeed, it does.
Yes, it does. So that is our look at the U.S. Navy and the supporting structures that go with that. Thanks for joining us. We will see you here next time on Vashon 250.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.